Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where University of Illinois students of theater and opera provoke laughter and tears in productions of Shakespeare's comedy As You Like It, Feydeau's farce, A Flea in Her Ear, and an evening that pairs two short operas set in Spain, Ravel's L'Heure Espagnole and Defia's La Vida Breve. Visit KrannertCenter.com for more information.
It's 106. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. We bring you an archive interview on this edition of the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour. So, as this is a pre-recorded program, we're not taking phone calls today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. They call themselves the Kitchen Sisters. They are Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, and they are our guests today. Their most recent project, Hidden Kitchens, running on Morning Edition, is described as an exploration of the world of street corner cooking, kitchen rituals, and how communities come together through food. And the Kitchen Sisters, who have been working together on radio stories since 1979, have always been interested in community and building community by telling stories. Their call for stories about secret and or hidden kitchens went out over the air. They opened a hotline at NPR, and the calls poured in.
I'm calling about a Friday night fish fry that's in my local community in Lake Waccamaw.
If you're looking for the ultimate hidden kitchen, it is our Meals on Wheels kitchen. You can't see it from the main street. There's no sign.
I work as a contract cook for science expedition trips on the Colorado River in Grand Canyon.
Message 15.
The cooking club is often the only chance that the ladies of Skid Row get to eat fresh food.
My family has a hidden kitchen in our barn near our house. We used to cook our turkey in a trash can. So the men in the family, it's been a good chance to talk and sit around.
You have 62 new messages.
Hello, my name is Ellen Burkett Morris. I was calling to tell you all about a Kentucky tradition, burgoo, which is sort of a frontier stew, and it's served every year at the Kentucky Colonel's barbecue around Derby time. They've got, you know, ladies in fancy hats sipping iced tea and old guys wearing really loud jackets who are talking, and the governor's always on hand greeting people and working the crowd. And they begin cooking in huge pots the night before, and they know when they're going to have a particularly good batch of burgoo when the cooking crew hears a plop in the middle of the night. Legend has it that there's a nest of black snakes in the trees above the kettles, and from time to time one of the snakes will climb out onto a limb to get a whiff of the stew and actually fall in.
The Hidden Kitchen series has now grown into a book and three-disc audio compilation. What we just heard comes from the audio version of the book Hidden Kitchens, Stories, Recipes, and More from NPR's The Kitchen Sisters. Nikki, Davia, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us, Lift.
My
pleasure.
Pleasure
to be here.
Well, tell us, first of all, how you came to call yourselves The Kitchen Sisters.
We started out in radio so many years ago, about 25 years ago now, and we were working at a small non-commercial station in Santa Cruz, California. And we were getting ready to do an on-air interview. The night before, we were boning up. We were reading this author's book, who had written about the architecture of Santa Cruz County, where we live. And we found this remarkable story about these two brothers, the Kitchen Brothers, who were stonemasons in the 1940s in Santa Cruz, and they built by the light of the moon, and they built towers out of abalone shell and stone to send and receive messages to the submarines that they thought were lurking out in the Monterey Bay during World War II. And these crazy stories had sort of come from just the neighborhood. I mean, it was the neighborhood oral mystery of the Kitchen Brothers. And we were so caught up in that story that we burned the dinner that we were trying to make in my new house that we had just moved into. And the next day when we were on the air, we made a joke with the author, you know, tell us about the Kitchen Sisters, the Kitchen Brothers, not to be confused with the Kitchen Sisters who are here with you today. And the name just stuck. And it's just been great because it's that feeling of being around the kitchen table and a lot of the things that we do, interviewing people and spending time with people, listening to their stories, is very much like what you do over a good meal.
Mm, yeah. Now, who told that story? Who did we just hear from there?
Oh, this is Nikki.
Okay,
yeah.
Nikki.
Yeah.
Okay, Davia, you're next. So I've got to ask you, what did you have for breakfast?
Oh, God, we had a great breakfast. We just got back. We were up at the crack of dawn, and we didn't have breakfast. And only about a half hour ago, someone had told us that we had to try a little place called M. Henry. So I had a Chipotle black bean omelet with applewood bacon, and I couldn't help myself. I ordered a single pancake because I'm sort of obsessed with pancake breakfasts, and probably that's part of the secret route of the Hidden Kitchen series, and it with warm berries, and we had about 22 cups of coffee between us.
Wow, you're ready to rock for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, breakfast at lunchtime.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and Nikki, what did you have?
I had pretty much the same with a little yogurt on the side to just smooth things out a bit.
Yeah. Now, when did the two of you begin asking people you were about to interview what they had for breakfast as a way to begin making a connection with them?
Somewhere early on, we must have gone to some radio training workshop or something, but we heard that people from the BBC, that was the question they asked, what did you have for breakfast? It's the first thing when you're trying to get levels on your tape recorder, when you're getting to know somebody and you're putting a microphone in their face, and you don't want to start with the most profound and meaningful question, the real reason that you're there for the interview. You want to start with something that everyone can answer, that is an easy starter, that is just that one common thing. People know what they had for breakfast. They can answer it, and during that time, everyone kind of gets comfy, and you got your levels, and there you go. So it's been 25 years of... We have a heck of a collection of what people ate for breakfast.
And you know, it's interesting when people come and are with me in the studio. It's a little intimidating in here with the microphones and screens and buttons and all that jazz. And I always just say, let's pretend we're in my kitchen.
Mm-hmm. It is the room in the house where the best stories are told and smells the best, and all good parties begin and end in the kitchen. There's just something about that, isn't there?
Yep, there sure is. The Kitchen Sisters are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. We've already got a listener waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Let's go and talk with a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. You answered part of my question about the Kitchen Sisters, but what I've always wondered is, are you actual sisters?
We're soul sisters, but we are not biological sisters, although we might as well be. We're really close friends, and we met about 25 years ago, and we've been work partners and friends ever since.
Okay, thanks.
But we had a great experience. We were at a bookstore doing a book signing, and someone said, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, is Kitchen your maiden name? And that, for us, was the big reveal. So, yes, Kitchen is our maiden name.
Yeah, there you go.
I think, you know, Kitchen Sisters is us, but it's way bigger than us. We are a producing duo, but there's a real team of about 10 people that are Kitchen Sisters with us. You know, we work collaboratively. We do all kinds of big national collaborations, and there are Kitchen Sisters and Kitchen Brothers out there that we've been working with for, you know, decades now. So it's an inclusive term.
Yeah. One of your Kitchen Brothers is Jay Allison. Tell us about the working relationship you have.
He's all the way across the country in Woods Hole and Cape Cod, and he's just an incredible radio genius, and he has pulled the community of independent producers together for absolutely years. He's been a friend of ours for nearly as long as we've been working together, And whenever we kind of start cooking on a new idea, we call him up to brainstorm with him and to think it through. And with the Hidden Kitchen series and with the Sonic Memorial project that we worked on and the Lost and Found Sound series, Jay has been there with us. And he's especially been active as the curator of these of our hotline. When we open the NPR hotline, he's the one whose voice you hear on the message machine, and he's the one that puts the call out to listeners. And it's been great. I mean, people call that hotline, and it's as if they're long friends. They say, Jay, Kitchen Sisters, I have something to tell you. It's very personal. It's as if we've always known people.
Yeah. Jay, also, I think in part Jay's role as curator of these quests led him, he was already thinking about this, I believe, with producer Dan Gettleman, but I think it sort of inspired them to open up that This I Believe line on NPR that leads them to, you know, be able to do what they're doing with the This I Believe series. It's wonderful how the public radio system is this real sort of incubator, and we're all influencing each other's projects.
Yeah, well, as a listener, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the entire Kitchen family for the great radio that you've given us.
Well, a lot has come from Chicago. You know, we've been the story in the series about the George Foreman Grill, an unexpected hidden kitchen of the homeless. We were led to Jeffrey Newton, who is a man homeless here in Chicago, who was cooking under Wacker Drive, Lower Wacker Drive, with a George Foreman Grill on the streets, plugging into power poles, and the Chicago Coalition of the Homeless helped us meet Jeffrey, and then we met Rick Kogan, who writes for the Tribune here, and whose family was friends with Nelson Algren, and a lot of people in Chicago have been helping with this series, too.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the series. You know, the question, what did you have for breakfast, did not lead to Hidden Kitchens. It was an observation that Davia made in San Francisco as the result of riding in lots of taxi cabs.
Yeah, I don't like to drive much, and I take a lot of cabs, and I started noticing that every time I got in a yellow cab in San Francisco, the driver was from Brazil, and not just from Brazil, but the same town in Brazil, Goiânia. Every time that I was in these cabs, I would notice the drivers, you know, they would just love to talk about music and food, and that would that led them to telling me a story about this woman, Jeanette, and her cab yard kitchen, a woman who comes at night outside the cab yard and cooks in this little mobile rolling night kitchen. And for that reveal came this whole sort of possibilities of who was cooking on corners, who was out there.
Yeah, and a reveal is kind of like a eureka moment?
Yeah, the reveal is when you go, oh, my God, it's not just Jeanette's story. It's just how do people get a toehold in a new country? How do immigrants open up new businesses? Who else is tending and feeding their community through food? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then you give it a title, and that's when you have a series.
Yeah. Well, let's give listeners a sense of what the street outside the cab company feels like in the middle of the night when Jeanette's cooking.
After midnight, that's when the big crowd come over. Taxi drivers come by all the time.
It's just kebab and rice and beans and chicken. Eugene, this is Manjar.
I drive the yellow cab. She comes here and cooks for us. You know?
The sidewalk in the middle of nowhere, in full moon but covered with hazy and fog.
On a blue tent in front of the garage of Yellow Cab San Francisco.
She's here till 4, 6, 7 in the morning.
I'm from Brazil. It's about 386 Brazilians driving a cab. Jeanette's food feel like home.
My name is Janet. I make a cooking. Abrir business, small business, aqui. Só para a comunidade da Yellow Cab.
Jeanette's Cab Yard Kitchen.
There you go, Jeanette's Cab Yard Kitchen. What's the food? What's the food like?
Oh, the food was beautiful. It's really simple food, beautifully grilled. You know, shish kebabi, as she says, shish kebabs, grilled chicken. She does these sort of hot salgadinhos, these little bite-sized sort of appetizer things, and cheese breads and black beans and really fresh salads. Brazilians are salad freaks. They love a good salad. So, you know, there it is 2 in the morning and, you know, middle of nowhere, you can get this gorgeous salad. And, you know, someone's always got their cab parked and they keep the door open and Brazilian music. You could hear it in the background. Mm-hmm. There's Brazilian music playing as everyone's eating. A couple of times when I went to the kitchen, there was musicians there, you know, cab drivers or their friends with guitars hanging out playing music. But it wasn't only Brazilians eating there, too. It was the Iranian drivers, the Russian drivers. The nightclubs closed around that area, and the kids would come from the clubs and eat there. It was just this little universe, kitchen universe.
Yeah, I wonder if business is now really booming for Jeanette.
Well, I think business is changing, and actually we're continuing to chronicle Jeanette, and we plan to do a piece for her as a hidden kitchen that will be on Morning Edition soon. And it's been an interesting story because all of these stories have their flip sides and their double edges. And Jeanette's has really changed in her quest for a mobile kitchen and, you know, just following her in her progress as she's been trying to get a toehold in this country as an immigrant has been a real interesting saga.
Yeah. Now, are there other people you've kept in touch with?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear you. Other
people in the series?
Yeah, are there other people that you've made friends with now?
Oh, God, yeah. Each of these stories leads us into an entire sort of kitchen family. And Angelo Garo, for example, we're on a book tour right now with the Hidden Kitchen series. We've been traveling around America, and Angelo Garo, who people heard in the Hidden Kitchen series, it's called The Forager, Hunting and Gathering with Angelo Garo. He lives in San Francisco. He's a Sicilian blacksmith. He forages, but he also forages and goes and gathers wild mushrooms, wild eels, wild fennel, ducks, you name it. He hunts and gathers. Anyway, Angelo heard about the book tour, and he was so thrilled that now the story was in a book, and we were traveling around the nation with it. He made a case of homemade wine for the bookstore. So we come to every bookstore with Angelo's homemade wines. And I don't know if your listeners heard the story that was on Morning Edition a couple weeks back now about, it was called King's Candy, a New Orleans kitchen vision. The man who'd been in solitary confinement in the prison in Louisiana for 29 years and had a hidden kitchen in his cell and made pralines. And now that he's out of prison, he makes these remarkable pralines. He calls them freelines, and he goes around the country talking about political prisoners and the rights of prisoners, and he makes candy all. It's just gorgeous candy. Anyway, we're traveling with freelines as well, so it's not just the friends, it's the food.
Yeah.
And it's not just the food, it's the fellowship.
Yeah.
And through his stories, he's really been, you know, people have really responded to his story of his freelines, as he calls them, and have been ordering them to give as holiday gifts. And so, you know, it's just opened up this whole new chapter. So we're in constant communication with King now about his candy operation and what's up.
Yeah. And it was after Katrina that you met him, correct?
Well, you know, there had been a call to the Hidden Kitchens hotline. And actually, it's a message that we included in the book. We had, as Davio said, hundreds and hundreds of people called. And we had planned to get back to many of them and are still getting back to many of them as the series goes on. And that was a message that we had received before Hurricane Katrina. A woman called in and told us about King and about his hidden kitchen in prison at Angola State Prison in Louisiana. And we had been meaning to follow up on it, had planned to. And after Katrina, an email came by, a newsletter came by our desk that was listing missing people from New Orleans, and King's name was on the list. And we said, my God, that's King. You know, this is that call we were going to call about, and it led us to try and follow up on him, and it turned out that King was missing, but his friends from Austin had commandeered a boat, had bought a boat and gone in and rescued him and brought him out. And just as it happened, King had left New Orleans or was brought out of New Orleans and wound up in San Francisco, which is where we're based. Mm. And we were able to document his story from there. And actually, it was for us that he made his first pralines since he'd been out of prison so that we could take them on the road on our book tour.
Yeah, he was a resident of the Algiers neighborhood mm-hmm. of New Orleans. You know, listening to that story earlier this month, and the other stories as they ran, they have been sit up in bed, stop the morning madness moments for me. What was it like for you as you lived with these stories through the production of the series, and the series is continuing?
It's like having this huge extended family all around the country, and it's, you know, I think when you work on these stories, there are 7-minute stories that run on Morning Edition, and it is such a huge deal, especially because so many of these stories are about people who stories are so rarely told on the media. You just don't often hear, you know, the story of this family that had the secret civil rights kitchen in Montgomery, or a raw milk dairy family farm in McCordsville, Indiana, and the surrounding farmers markets around them, and the issues of grass-fed beef and one neighbor turning against another and trying to get a raw milk dairy shut down. Anyway, it's by the time a story hits the air, there's usually several hundred people deeply involved in the telling of it, the gathering of it, the finding of things, and it's like moving with a traveling circus each story across the country. But I think we hear what's not in the stories when they air. The stories when they air, they're celebrations for us, but they're a little bit like a moment where you kind of grieve the tape that's on the cutting room floor. And you immediately, we are always, as we're listening, we're immediately going, the minute we get off of Morning Edition, we're going to make an hour-long special, and we're going to restore all the great cuts that we didn't get to put in because there are so many tributaries. I mean, we speak of King Wilkerson, the Secret Civil Rights Kitchen. He told this remark. He wanted to be a singer when he was growing up, and he was, Sam Cooke was his idol, and he tells a Sam Cooke story in there that's so beautiful, and we wish so much to be able to tell that because it was just a piece of poetry, the way this man told the story. But it's a little sidetrack from the main story of the Freelanes and the hidden prison cook kitchen. So, you know, the listening experience is kind of complicated for us.
Yeah,
and that's been kind of the great thing about the book, is we've been able to, a lot of the stories that it have aired on Morning Edition, and to really include a lot of those side roads and, you know, tales about the people that never quite made it to air, that we really feel kind of round the story out and complete it in a way. And also, all along the way, we gathered photographs and archival images, as well as contemporary shots, and those things we were able to include, and recipes, which was wonderful. We could never really share any of the great things we gathered along the way until the book. So
yeah, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful seeing the faces of the people that we got to know through the stories on the radio. And
I like seeing the hands of the people, too. I'm looking at the book as we're talking. I'm looking at George Gilmore's hands and just thinking, you know, you aspire to create radio that people smell and see, or, you know, where they could see it on that detail. But it's kind of nice to see it, too.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of the picture. I love the picture of the woman who uses a crock pot in her SRO to make red beans and rice. And what a beautiful face. And boy, wouldn't you like to be able to, you know, invite her over to your house for a meal and then go over to her house, you know, and enjoy the red beans and rice. It has become family.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's an extraordinary woman. She works at the Glide Memorial Church Walk-In Center in San Francisco in the Tenderloin District. And she lived in an SRO herself, single-room occupancy, a place for a long time. And legally, as with so many of these places, you can't have a kitchen. So, you know, as people, first of all, how are people on such a fixed income expected to eat if they're in soup kitchen lines? That's a forever kind of thing, and people don't always want to eat in those circumstances. To eat out is so expensive, or you're eating fast food and kind of junkier food. And so many people have that deep human basic fundamental need to cook. It's so primal. It's sort of who we are as a species, or one part of who we are. And so out of that human need comes this inventive clandestine spirit. The woman you're speaking of, Pat Sherman, she talked about how making, you have a crock pot, but during the day you make it look like a flower pot or a pencil holder, and you make your George Foreman grill, because it comes in all these fancy colors, look like a little modern tabletop, and things hidden under the bed and surreptitious ways, but all you're really trying to do is make a pot of beans.
Yeah, yeah. So simple and so somehow so elegant And also eloquent, I guess we could use that word as well. I mean, it just says volumes about people and creativity. Speaking of the crock pot and speaking of appliances, you've mentioned now a couple of times the George Foreman grill. Maybe we could take a listen to a clip from the story of George Foreman's grill. What do you say?
That would be great.
Yes, I'm Margaret Engel, co-author of Food Finds. The George Foreman grill has been an amazing success story as a kitchen appliance, but what I think many people don't realize is that immigrants and low-income people, the people who struggle to even get food on the table because they don't have an official kitchen and who are using George Foreman grills and the like, and it's a much safer way than a hot plate. That is, to me, the epitome of the hidden kitchen.
Wow. What a wonderful story. I'd never considered it at all.
And that is George Foreman himself.
Mm-hmm. That was so remarkable to talk with George Foreman about the fact that homeless people and people in SROs were using his grill as a hidden kitchen. He had never heard that. It completely stunned him. And as soon as we told him that story, he launched into the most amazing story of his own childhood, which was a childhood of hunger, where he never had enough to eat, one of seven kids. And he talked about how, you know, he'd watch kids eating through the windows in the neighborhood and watch the parents cut the crusts off the bread and throw the crusts off, and he would just wish that they would throw something out to him. And how when he'd go to school, he was so humiliated that he didn't have a lunch that he would blow up a greasy paper bag, and he would pretend like he had a lunch in it, and he'd carry it. And then at lunchtime, he'd you know, kind of squish it up and throw it away, and he says, "Oh, I already ate my lunch," because he was so embarrassed that he didn't have food to eat. And he talked about how being hungry made him angry, and it really propelled him almost all through his life. And today he has all of these wonderful summer camps where he is concerned with feeding children and making sure kids have three meals a day, because that was a real turning point in his life when he finally got three meals a day when he joined the Job Corps and was finally, you know, fed. Alice Waters wrote the introduction to the book, and she said something that just really struck me. She said, "You know, I never would have imagined that I had that anything in common or anything much in common with George Foreman until I read that we're both concerned about, you know, children going to school hungry, and that this issue of food is a real common issue and something that brings us all together."
Mm. Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, the Kitchen Sisters, are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Their most recent project is Hidden Kitchens. It's running on Morning Edition. Described as an exploration of the world of street corner cooking, kitchen rituals, and how communities come together through food. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, your kitchen stories. The telephone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The Hidden Kitchen series has grown into a book and a three-disc audio compilation, and we've been listening to some clips this afternoon here on the program that come from the audio version of the book, Hidden Kitchens, Stories, Recipes, and More, from NPR's The Kitchen Sisters. The book is published by Rodale, and the audio is available in this three-disc compilation from Audio Renaissance. Let's take another call. A listener in Belgium, in Illinois, on line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I just want to relate a short story about her beloved city, San Francisco, there. Several years ago, when my family first moved out there, we were staying down near Fisherman's Wharf at a Holiday Inn in the general area, and it's mid-morning, and my wife and I walk out of the place looking for some place for a late breakfast. We're wandering along and talking to ourselves, and this gentleman walks out of essentially an alley, and he says, "Were you looking for breakfast?" And we said, "Well, sure." He says, "Well, come and join me," and we both looked at ourselves and said, do we want to do this? And we stepped back into this alley, and this fellow and his significant other who was also a fellow, which we won't get into, walked back, and they had taken essentially like a garage and a little backyard and turned it into a bit of a restaurant. And had the most fabulous breakfast and little area to sit in and everything. They cooked off a hot plate and just entertained us thoroughly. And I don't know the address.
Oh, come on. We're going to have to hypnotize you until you remember it.
And it's even worse than that. We've gone back and tried to find them again, and they've since left.
Oh, but that is the ultimate hidden kitchen.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
That's exactly
someone just having to share.
Yeah, it was just so fabulous. I mean, just, and, you know, I never thought of it in your context ever before until I started listening to your show.
Oh.
But we were just delighted with the little stay with these fellas.
Mm. Nope. I know, and you wind up in this conversation with people you might otherwise not meet. You see how, I mean, people so spontaneously, I think what we keep seeing is we were doing the collecting for the series during the last presidential election, and so many people we knew around the country were feeling in such despair that America was so divided, that there was red, there was blue, there was all this hostility in two camps, three camps. And, you know, yes, all that's true, but there are all these people, these sort of, we see them as this whole group of community leaders, these unsung kitchen heroes, people with this sort of gumption and this creativity and this imagination and inspiration. And, you know, half these people are cooking because their schools don't have enough money and they're going to help raise it, or the library might close, so they're going to do a fish fry, or the veterans don't have what they need, so they're going to do a crab boil. And, you know, just people will find a way to knit themselves together. If, I mean, there's, I think through the kitchen comes a lot of possibilities of peace and fellowship, like you say.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Other stories are invited. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else you're listening, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. The Kitchen Sisters are our guests this afternoon in this portion of the program. Let me pause here to remind our listeners that a tornado watch is in effect for Champaign, Coles, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, and Vermilion counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area until 5 o'clock Central Time this evening. So how many calls have come in to the hotline to date?
There are 2,879 minutes of messages.
Whew.
So far to date on the Hidden Kitchens hotline. That breaks down to 36 CDs of messages. The phone calls came to NPR's Morning Edition, and this wonderful crew of people at Morning Edition would then dump it from the phone machine onto CDs and send them to us all, to Jay's team in Woods Hole at Cape and Islands Radio, and then to us on the West Coast, and we'd all pour through these CDs and listen. So it's a bounty.
One of the reasons it's hard to say exactly how many people called is that so many people didn't call once, didn't call twice, but called three and four times because we limited people to, well, our phone machine limited them to how many minutes they could talk. And, you know, people were so passionate calling in. They just, their stories were busting out of the phone line, and they just had to keep calling, and they'd pick up where they left off.
We say these weren't messages, these were house calls. I mean, because people had such a sense of urgency, because also we said to the nation, what food traditions are endangered on the verge of extinction? What do we need to capture before it disappears and is no longer in your neighborhood, in your town, on the planet? And so people were really saying, you better get there, or else this store is closing tomorrow. These elders are about to die. They're plowing up that piece of land, and the ramps won't grow there anymore. I mean, there are so many things that were just had this tenuous little toehold, and we're about to go.
Yeah. Now, there is a wonderful story of preservation in the book and in the CD collection, and that involves Winona Duke. And yeah, she is wonderful. Her story is a full circle kind of story. She says it takes generations. She is living and working on the White Earth Indian Reservation in Minnesota. Tell us about her.
Well, she's just a remarkable woman. She ran for vice president, some might remember, with Ralph Nader in his first bid for the presidency. She's a woman with a vision and a whole lot of gumption. Talk about a leader. She grew up in California and returned to her father's reservation after she went to Harvard. And when she got there, she just kind of looked around and was trying to find a way that this very poor Indian reservation could somehow sustain itself. And she began this project, the White Earth Land Recovery Project, with some of the elders of the tribe, and they began searching for ways that they could just become more sustainable. And she says in the piece and in the book that she didn't want to bring yet another factory to the reservation and try and impose some factory life onto the people. And she tried to look at what folks were doing and what people were good at. And one of the cornerstones of her work is rice, the wild rice that grows on the lakes in northern Minnesota, and harvesting the wild rice. And so they've opened up a whole processing shed, and they're buying rice from the people on the reservation. And they are they have an internet site where you can actually buy wild rice, and also birch bark baskets and crafts from the tribe, and chokeberry jam and maple candy. They have a mapling, a maple sugar processing that they do in the springtime. She has really done magnificent work with, and her entire group is working to really make the tribe a model and a more sustainable community. They go out and build greenhouses for the elders, and they have a seed sharing program where they distribute seeds to people. And with the level of diabetes and disease and obesity on the reservation, they're just seeing food as a real way to make a big difference and change in their community.
Mm. Now, preserving our stories, the stories of our families, preserving a way of life, food is a great way in, as you've discovered. Have you heard from people who you've inspired to begin to save, to record family stories, and the front door is food, or the back door is food?
I think somehow, because this notion of hidden kitchens was being put out onto the radio over the last year, and word of the book, and then these hour-long specials that are running on public radio, I think there's a lot of people. I mean, we especially hear from the really old and the really young. It's really wonderful, this sort of bridge across generations where people are noticing it. Suddenly they stop and notice something more about where they live. If, you know, we go to these bookstores and we start talking about Angelo and his prosciuttos and his fennel and his Sicilian poached eggs, and next thing we know, some young guy is telling us, well, yes, I started thinking about it, and I'm starting to, you know, cure my own meats and go out and learn how to find the mushrooms. And I think it's like you hear a great record on the radio, and you've been kind of thinking you want to start a band and play with your friends. I think people are inspired by what's in the air around them, and if you put out these small kitchen stories, and we sort of say these unsung kitchen heroes, and if you treasure that and shed some light on that, I think it is sparking people to push it a little bit.
And there's also even
to get small,
right? Even in the book, one recipe particularly that I love is Francis Coppola's homeless meatballs for 500. Every year, Francis Coppola and Lawrence Ferlinghetti do this big event, a fundraising event in San Francisco, where they cook these meatballs that are from Francis's family, and they raise money for the homeless in the community. And we put this recipe in the book in the hopes that, you know, folks just might want to try that recipe for 500 and raise some money in their community for the homeless or for some other community cause that really needs support.
Yeah. The two of you, you know a good story when you come across one, but I'm wondering, were you surprised by the response that you've received to your call for kitchen stories?
Yeah, I think we were. I mean, we never imagined we'd hear about a traveling circus and a family that had this family traveling circus for years and years, and would gather under the big top and have these huge, elaborate circus meals together. And when they came to the Chicago area, would go to the Armor Factory and buy huge sides of beef. I mean, yeah, they're, you know, a clandestine kitchen like the George Foreman Grill. We never imagined we'd hear from a NASCAR chef cooking in the crew pits of NASCAR on that circuit, and that would lead us into the racing world of NASCAR. I think also we never imagined that once the NASCAR chef heard the George Foreman story, that he would call us and say, "I cried when I heard George Foreman talk about the hunger of his childhood." We say when the stories start dating one another, it's a term we have. You know, once people start leaping the firewall from their story to somebody else's and find those connections, absolutely. The calls have been, you know, we were led to Georgia Gilmore's story by a call from a fellow in the South who told us about her kitchen. I mean, we find a lot of them. Sometimes the stories find us. And
I've just been so impressed by how people just take it on as they know what a hidden kitchen is. I mean, we didn't explain it very clearly as to what we were looking for, but people just knew that what a hidden kitchen was to them in their lives. And sometimes it was just some family tradition that in their own family they cherished and wanted to share. And sometimes it was some big social issue.
Or a parking lot kitchen after a Grateful Dead concert or a Fish concert, and all the burritos and grilled cheese sandwiches and vegan food being made for you know, the audience as it spills out of the Grateful Dead.
And, you know, we received this one call from a school teacher in Tacoma, Washington, and she'd been teaching for about 20 years and home economics, and she was calling because she was so concerned by what she was seeing in her classroom over the last 4 or 5 years. She makes this assignment that kids have to cook something at home, but because there's so little cooking going on in so many homes, she would have to give out measuring spoons and measuring cups and the utensils to cook because kids didn't have access to that in their kitchens. And she was talking about one girl had never had a meal prepared in her home. It had been takeout, you know, since she was born. And that's a sad story, but the end of the woman's message was this call to arms. She said, "I don't think America wants this to happen. I think we need to look at this. We can change this." And it was just this passion that people had that has been so astonishing to me and wonderful.
Speaking of passion, before we run out of time, thoughts on barbecue?
People get awfully passionate about what is it about men and midnight and meat in a pit. You know, there is just some serious disagreement, and people, those are fighting words.
And competition.
But wouldn't that be great if that was the kind of level of fight that we were having in this country versus ideology and religion? But like whether it should be a rub, a sauce, whether it should be peppers or vinegar, it's the kind of fight we like.
Yeah. Well, my brother, Chris, would say, "It's all good." It's all good.
It's all good.
Yeah. Well, we've got to wrap it up here. And to go out, I want to play one more clip from the audiobook. Before we do that, though, any final thoughts you want to sum up? You want to anything we should you want us to take away here
well,
this Frances afternoon?
Well, Frances McDormand narrated that audiobook,
yes.
And I feel like she joined the family of public radio. She heard about this Hidden Kitchens project, and we were talking about the audiobook, and she was hearing some of these things, and she said, "You know, I've always wanted to do something for public radio." And we said, "Well, how would you like to be the narrator of Hidden Kitchens?" And so she became that. It's these morning edition stories and way, way more, and Frances brings you through it. And in the end, she said to us, "Some of the nicest words I've ever gotten to say in a script were for National Public Radio." This is Frances McDormand. And so I just feel like passing that on to Chicago because that's what she wanted said.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned her because I, like you, felt like I had left her on the floor here today.
Celeste, we are so happy to be on Chicago, and we just are looking for more Chicago Hidden Kitchens because the series continues.
Okay, and into January and beyond?
Way beyond.
Way beyond. Excellent. Okay. And the two of you are in the Chicago area, and this evening you're going to be at Anderson's in Naperville.
Yes.
7 p.m. at Anderson's Bookstore in Naperville, Illinois. Happy trails. Thank you so much. And let's go out here with one more clip from Hidden Kitchens. This is one of the calls that I enjoyed very much coming across on one of the CDs.
Hi, this is Don Rossler, and I'm sending you guys a song about a refrigerator, which, I guess is fairly essential in just about every kitchen. It's not only the center of activity, but also, for a lot of people, the emotional center. I don't mean just in terms of emotional comfort from food. It's where the pictures and drawings and stuck-up memos and Little League schedules and recipes hang. It's probably where everyone you know or people you've hung out with and in the kitchen at various times in life are represented. It's also, in a weird way, represents the ones we've taken down off the fridge. I guess it's actually about family and whatever that is to you as well. You know, and the kitchen is where the family gathers and changes over the years, all represented in a sad and bittersweet song called Christine's Refrigerator.
I want my picture to stay upon Christine's refrigerator. Though I'm no longer with her, I want to stay there taped between her sister with a birthday cake, her little brother standing on his head. All my boxes have been moved. There's a TV I'll take later. We were happy, so I thought. Well, to her like she said. Don't have much family left in my life.
And that's one of the selections from Hidden Kitchens. That's the audio book. And our thanks this afternoon to the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. The Hidden Kitchens radio series, which is airing on Morning Edition, has grown into a book and a three-disc audio compilation. And we've been hearing this afternoon from the audio book, from the audio version of Hidden Kitchens, stories, recipes, and more from NPR's The Kitchen Sisters. The book is published by Rodale and the audiobook by Audio Renaissance.
And that was an archive version of the Afternoon Magazine recorded back in November of last year. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. We have the settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade. With those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Tom. Hey, I have an answer, by the way, to the question that was asked at the end of that program. What is it about men, meat, and midnight? The answer is beer.
Yes.
I think that's what the answer is. The other
we'll
answer to the question is 4-H. For those who don't know how to cook and want to teach their kids, put them in 4-H. Of course, I represent Extension, so I'm a little biased on that. But it's an awfully good program, and they can learn all about home economics, and they can go bake and learn how to frost cakes and all that kind of stuff at people's homes that really know how to do that kind of stuff. Now, from the Chicago Board of Trade, those ag products look like this. We'll start with wheat, which is sometimes used in cake mix, depending on which sort of wheat it is. Kansas City Board of Trade, hard red winter wheat. The March contract, a high today at 395, a low at 391. Settlement price at 393. They're off 4.5 cents. July futures, 396.75. The high, the low at 93.5, and a settlement price at 99.5, down 2.75. That's your hard red winter wheat. It's used, I believe, in breads. And then the spring wheats, which change at Minneapolis Grain Exchange, would be your cake wheats. We don't talk about those here at the Board of Trade, at WILL very often. March wheat, soft red winter wheat in Chicago, 341.5. The high, the low at 337.5. This is the wheat that's grown here in the Midwest. 339.25, down 4 cents for that March contract. The May futures, 352 the high, the low at 48.5. Settlement price at 350.25, down 4.25. This kind of wheat you use to make crackers. July, 361.75 the high, the low at 358.25. Settlement price at 360.25, down 4.25. And September futures, 371 the high, Low at 368.25. Settlement price there at 370.5. They're off three. December futures down 3.75 today at 382.75. From the corn pit, lower there day there as well. Most of this coming in sympathy with the big moves down in the bean pit. We'll talk about that with Paul Cooley later this afternoon. March contract down 2.25 in the corn pit, 217.75 the high. Low at 15.25. Settlement price at 216.5, down 2.25. And the May corn, 228 the high, the low at 225.5. Settlement price at 226.5, down 2.5. July futures 237 the high, the low at 234.5. Settled 236, they're down 2 in September's. A penny and a half lower today, the high at 44.5, a low at 42.75. Settlement price for the SEP corn, 243.75, down 1.5. December contract now, new crop, 254.75 high, low at 252.5. Settlement price at $2.54 a bushel. December corn off a penny and 3/4. March futures down 1.25 at 260.25. March oats 192 unchanged. The May futures at 189.5. They were down 2.5 for the day. March soybeans now 589.25. The high, the low at 79. Settlement price at $5.79.5. Off 14.75. Some good rains across Argentina, and of course didn't manage to stay above some resistance levels yesterday, so they're moving lower. May futures 601. The high, the low at 591.5. A settlement price at 592.25, down 14.5, and July 611.5 the high, the low at 602.5. Settlement price at 603, they're off 13.5. August soybeans 613.5 the high, the low at 606. Settlement price at 606, down 13.5 cents. In September futures, they're off a dime, 615 the high, the low at 610. Settled on that low, down 10 cents in the SEPs. November beans, 623.5 the high, the low at 616. Settlement price at $6.16.75. They were off 12.75 in the Januaries, down 10.5 cents at 623.5. March bean meal, 183.30 the high, low at 180.60. Settlement price at 181.20. They were down 3.80. And the May meal finished down 410 at 184.80. May bean oil, 22.77 the high, the low at 22.23. Settled 54 lower at 22.25. In a moment, we'll get the numbers on the Mercantile Exchange from Tom. I'm Todd Gleason, and I'll be back with the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Chip Jorstad in Morris at 815-941-3706. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And here are the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. The March feeder cattle contract today had a high of 110.30, the low 109.25. The settlement was at 109.27.5, just under the or over the low. It was down 55 cents on the day. April feeders had a high of 111.10, the low 109.90, settled at 110.35, down 50. And the May contract had a high of 111.55, the low 110.35, settled at 110.62.5, down 57.5. The live cattle for February, the high today 93.55 on the Merc, the low 92.65. 93.05 was the settlement. It settled down 50. And the April live cattle contract had a high of 91.65, the low 90.50, settled at 92.92.5. And that was down 65 on the day. Update for lean hogs, the February contract had a high of 56.50, the low 55.85, settlement at 56.22.5, up 27.5. April, the high 62.30, the low 61.60, settled at 62.02.5, up 20. May lean hogs at a high of 66.60, the low 66.05, settled at 66.35, up 7.5. And the FAR contract for hogs, the June.